IPAM and to the mathematicians who have set through the criminology things and the criminologists who have set through the mathematical things. We borrow from each other a lot, and sometimes we get it right, and sometimes we improve things, and sometimes we're really stubborn. You know, we don't want to give in to the other discipline. We want to hang on to our concepts. And what works best? Actually, I find this a lot in my interplay with geographers, where the geographers will have very elegant analytical approaches, but they lack the theoretical underpinnings, and so they get things wrong. And we have a lot of good theoretical stuff, and sometimes we aren't very elegant mathematically. So I came across an example of where two disciplines interface between each other, and it all depends on your approach to the problem as to what is the correct answer. Some of you have seen this, but from a geographic perspective, this is perfectly correct, you see. but it lacks. but I guess it lacks a little bit of mathematical elegance to it. So this I think is an example of when things go wrong, when you refuse to give up on your geographic, or I'm sorry, give up on your approach. Yes.
Is that your last line?
Here I am again.
George, another question. Did you want a question mark on your title? Swarming.
No, I don't.
Why, do you have a free one or something?
So what's going on here? Okay. This is actually an example of this. A lot of the research that I've gotten into over the years, I think a lot of you know, is when I don't accept something that has come from another discipline and I want to give an alternative approach to that. The residential burglary book that I wrote actually came out of some interplay that I had with economists, where they were using the model of economic man with perfect knowledge and using that knowledge in a perfectly rational manner, so that everybody obviously was going to the wealthy suburbs to rip off rich houses. And we knew that that wasn't the case, but we didn't know exactly why that wasn't the case. And of course, borrowing from Pat's work, we were able to show that it's pretty difficult to burglarize a house that you don't know anything about or where it is. I once was interviewing a burglar who said that he was going to rip off the owner of the Philadelphia Eagles because he knew where that owner was going to be every time the Eagles played a home game. The owner and his wife were at the game, so the house was obviously going to be empty. And I said, well, where is that house? He said, I don't know. That he was going to rip that house off, but he didn't know where it was.
Yeah. By the way, I found that professional athletes have very high victimization.
They do, yeah. There was one burglar working his way through the Philadelphia Flyers hockey team using just that methodology. And whenever they had a home game, he knew where the owner and his wife was going to be, and so he was working his way through the hockey team. In any case, this is what happened here. A Harvard scholar working in drug research, actually an acquaintance of mine, attacked the problem of why drug dealers agglomerate spatially. In other words, why they tend to cluster in space. And rather than analyzing it, he used armchair theorizing and logic. And he said, just logically, the reason drug dealers will cluster in space is the same reason, in borrowing from Jeff's work, or not Jeff's work, but Jeff's field, the same reason that birds flock and fish school. It's natural protection from predators. So if you get a lot of drug dealers in one area and the police arrive, if you all scatter in different directions, the police maybe will catch one and the rest of you are home free. So that was his logic as to why drug dealers cluster in space. I didn't accept that. I think that there's another reason. So to what I'm going to be talking about today is an alternative explanation for the same phenomena using economics and a bit of statistics. And what we're going to be doing today also is looking at aerial analysis. Most of what has been going on up to this point in time has been point pattern analysis. and we're going to develop aerial analysis using GIS to improve upon census variables, I believe. So where can drug markets locate? It doesn't make sense that two drug dealers that operate from the same corner, does it? And logically, we tend to say they wouldn't. You know, they'll fight each other to have that corner. But what we found is that if there are excess profits to be made at a corner, it is not uncommon, and John, I believe, has found this as well, it's not uncommon for many drug dealers to operate from the same neighborhoods. But the police will give you folk wisdom and interpreting their response to this. They'll say, well, it doesn't do any good to take this drug market away from them because they'll just hop over here and set up their market in another location. So hotspots policing, going in and taking out these drug dealers just doesn't really do any good because they're easily replaced and they'll just hop over to somewhere else. This we didn't accept either because we are going to try to make the argument that it is that spatial displacement of crime is not bad, but actually good. Because if you take the best place to sell drugs away from them, they'll have to sell in a second best place. And what does that mean? That means less profit. And what is our objective? Locking up drug dealers? No, because they're easily replaced. What we want to do is take some of the profit out of the drug dealing. And can we drive it down below a threshold level? And again, a lot of people say, well, drug dealers, they don't understand that they're out there to make a profit. It's not fun to sell drugs. You know, you want to stand out there in the rain, sleet, and snow like the mailman, you know? It's not fun, so why are they doing it? And the reason is because they are making money out of it. And so the question is, can we drive them below a threshold level that it is not profitable to sell drugs? So the scientific knowledge then, when we really begin to look at this, is that they're going to sell drugs in the neighborhoods that will give them the most profit, and also in the neighborhoods where they're going to be safe from detection, or relatively safe from detection, and safe from neighbors. Now, safe areas to sell drugs are generally thought to be in the socially disorganized neighborhoods. The sociologists have done a lot of analysis where they argue that the more disorganized the neighborhood, the less cohesion the neighbors will have, less social efficacy they will have, and the more freedom the drug dealers will have to operate. And if it isn't socially disorganized, you can, of course, expect resistance from the neighbors, sometimes collectively, sometimes individually. And in North Philly, of course, many of you have seen this, but here's an example of an individual who's taking no nonsense. I mean, I wouldn't want to be caught in this guy's area. You might lose part of your anatomy, right? So here is somebody that had made no bones about it. You're not only not going to sell drugs, you're not even going to sit in my neighborhood. just move along here. And he signed it, as you see, owner 357, so he's not even making it a secret as to who this individual is. But socially disorganized areas may be the least profitable areas because you have to have customers to buy illegal drugs. And again, one of the concepts that isn't well understood is the difference between local demand and regional demand. A location for that caters primarily to local demand simply has to have enough customers within the range of that drug market to stay in business. And if you become socially disorganized and people start leaving the area faster than people are moving in, you're going to be losing customers, and then the only way you can stay profitable is if you attract regional customers. And again, John, who's done most of the pioneering work on this, has illustrated that the best places for markets tend to be within a block or two of some of the interstate highways where they will attract regional customers. But if you aren't depending on the regional customers, then you have to have local demand. And the problem here is that illegal drug markets tend to attract drug-dependent property criminals. And in my research, I've been able to show that the drug market is actually more important than the home as an anchor point to these criminals. So they tend to come to the drug markets to buy their drugs and probe out from these drug markets to look for crime opportunities. And therefore, in the in and around these drug markets, you find a lot of abandoned houses as people move out faster than they move in. And the people that remain in the area will do things like this. Here's an example where somebody has simply put bars around their entire front porch. Here's another little cruder example. This one just built a cage around every opening in the house. So you want to buy this house? Most of us wouldn't want to live here. And of course, even low-income people, given the opportunity, are going to move out faster than people are moving in. And if that's the case, who are they going to sell drugs to? And again, this is something that people has been under research, is who is buying the drugs, and where are they located, and can you establish a profitable drug sales area in depending on local demand? So one of the things that I did in my early research was to take a look at housing abandonment, and it's hard to get data on this because some have flown over areas in the wintertime with heat monitoring and looking at what houses have heat in them and what don't, which don't. And of course, you get some people going to Florida that way. But one of the best measures of housing abandonment, I think, is when people stop paying their taxes and stop making repairs. And tax data is readily available. So we looked at that. Out from one of the most notorious drug markets in Philadelphia, which was 8th and Butler here. I can say that now. I didn't used to say it because I find it unethical to locate, drug markets for people. But but this is no longer a hot drug market. It's moved on. It's really an interesting phenomenon how these things evolve. It's like a wave effect moving across the city where once an area loses local demand, the drug marketers will move off and the area sometimes will revitalize. And that's basically what's happened with 8th and Butler. But to control for areas, you moved out. But what we did was look at T streets. You want out one up and then one across. And then the second block would be one up and one, one across in each direction. And the total for each of these directions is listed here. And what you can see is this is, let's see, which one is it here? This one is by far the highest, and that was the one going toward one of the major transportation arteries. But in any case, when we looked at tax delinquency for these houses, another phenomenon popped up here that is sort of an anomaly. Two blocks out is an anomaly, and we went and field checked that, and what they have is this block is trying to hold it together. They had flags across the streets and planners, they were really trying to hold it together. I think Mike Maltz argued the same thing, that every now and then you'll have a block that's an anomaly. But if you except for this block, you see it's monotonic as you moved outward from that drug sales area. It's tax delinquency in dollar amounts and years owed drop monotonically, with the exception of the second block out, which was directly threatened and trying to hold it together. Okay, and they were having some success in this. So which is it, profit or social disorganization? This is, of course, something that we can get a handle on. And when we look at profits, of course, there's actually three things that determine profits, and they're location, 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 right? The real estate people tell you that. The marketing people will tell you that. And I argue there's not a whole lot of difference between illegal drug markets and legal retail sales. And we're going to see this as we go along. You need ready access. You have to attract a large number of customers. And these are going to be your best markets for illegal drugs. So when you look at retail markets for legal commodities, very often people will start off with what we call demographic profiles. This is being done with the Super Bowl. Everybody's going to watch the Super Bowl ads, right? You'll probably turn on mute while the game's on, right? and then turn on the sound when the ads are on, right? But the ads are good. You know, they pay millions of dollars for these, and they know who's going to watch football, and they've targeted these ads accordingly. And some people accuse me of being a location analyst for illegal drug dealers. because I can do a demographic profile of who it is that tends to buy illegal drugs and show you where is the best place to set up your illegal drug market. Okay, and if you look at who purchases drugs from the household survey coming out of the University of Michigan, you can find that the drug users tend to be young adults between age 15 and 29. They tend to be high school dropouts because going to school interferes with the party lifestyle. You know, why are they dropping out of school? Because I argue that a lot of it has to do with lifestyle. If you're wanting to have a good crack high, math class is not where you want to do it. You know, and so you drop out of high school for a lifestyle. And the same go with the unemployed. Here I ran into a lot of difficulty when I published a suburban burglary book where I made the argument that crime causes unemployment rather than unemployment causing crime. The causal arrow was going in the wrong direction because most of the people that I interviewed held good jobs and quit them. Or were fired for reasons like, well, the boss is a jerk, you know. And I said, why was the boss a jerk? Because he wanted me to show up on work on time. You know, what a jerk, you know. And so they quit their jobs for a lifestyle of crime. And so you have to be careful in the direction of your causal arrows and things of this nature. But in any case, we can take those profiles and weight them by the proportion of the population who are drug users in these different age groups, and this is essentially what I did. And geography and marketing people have a lot of strategies for analyzing the optimal location for firms because a lot of research has gone into this. And the one that I picked was the location allocation model that I used first here. That has an objective function, demand points, feasible sites, a distance matrix, and an allocation rule. I'll go over this rapidly because this is not the heart of what I want to talk about, but we use the objective function of maximizing profit, maximizing sales volume by minimizing the distance that potential customers would have to travel to purchase drugs if everybody in the city purchased drugs at that location. So the demand points were the centroids of the census tract. The distance matrix was the distance between centroids, every census tract and every other census tract, in a matrix form. And the allocation rule, customers were assigned to the census tract that minimized person miles traveled to that census tract. The assumption, of course, all users in the city purchased drugs at this census tract. So when we did this analysis, we came in Wilmington, Delaware. We came up with census tract 1600. This wasn't very satisfactory to us because what we found was census tract 1600 was actually the one that was in the center of the city. And that wasn't what we wanted. So we set about relaxing some of the rules of the model, first being a planar model. Any location in the city is a potential site. We relax this because it is obvious that drug dealers aren't going to be dealing out in front of your house, are they? Okay? So when you get in relatively wealthy areas, you aren't going to have drug dealers. So we masked out areas where the median housing values were above average. And then the second one is one that is often gotten wrong by researchers, that that addicts will travel any distance to buy drugs. I had a colleague at Temple that did some ethnographic research, and he argued that a crack user traveled 7 miles every day to buy crack. And I said, you understand how far 7 miles was? You know, when I was a kid, I used to walk 7 miles into town to play a pinball machine, you know. But I didn't do it every day. And then when I got there, I was pretty tired, you know. And so this guy's going to walk 7 miles, buy some crack, walk 7 miles back. That's 14 miles, and he's not going to have enough energy to smoke it, is he? So clearly, I would walk a mile for a camel. And not exactly what is going on here. And so we wanted to, so what we did was assign zeros to the district matrix if two of these census centroids were more than a mile apart, and one if they weren't. And so we relaxed those two assumptions, and when we did, then it really worked out nicely. We located 2,223 and 1,400. And this ended up being 1, 2, and 3 in the census tracts that had the highest number of drug sales arrests, or highest density of drug sales arrests in them. 1,600 here in the more in the middle was 4th, and then we had another cluster out here that was 5th and 6th. So this worked out very, very nicely from a location point of view, but we still are left with a lot of area, aren't we? You know, for policing purposes, this is a lot of area. And we wanted to refine it down more than that, because if I want to tell my drug dealers where to set up, I want to tell them what corner to set up on, not somewhere in this area, you know. If you're working with Wawa on, or what is it, you know, some 7-Eleven, you know, you don't want to say, well, somewhere over in here, you got to just make, you know, put yourself a store somewhere over in here. You don't want to do that. You want to tell them exactly where to go. So we wanted to refine this further. And so what we did then was to refine this model down to try to get smaller areas, get more specific sites for our drug markets. And this required then a more refined analysis with geographic information systems that we used. So what can geographic information systems do for us? What I'm going to do is show you the traditional method that has been used before GIS. Then we're going to improve that with a couple of GIS methods here for how to locate specifically drug markets within these areas. So we're going to look at the traditional method pre-GIS and then move forward. So the traditional method relies on census space. By and large, they rely on census space or zip codes or something of this nature, but I'm going to use census data where we have census tract, block group, block faces or something of this nature, but the census boundaries are set, and they determine the spatial nature of the analysis. So in that regard then, if you had census tract 1 here and census tract 2 here, in the traditional method, what you would do is take that census tract and allocate the fixed features, the built features to it. So you'd say census tract 1 has all the census data with census tract 1 plus. It has 2 bars and a check caching store in it. Census tract 2 has just the check caching store in it. Even though a bar is very near the border, it doesn't count. Okay, because it's not in this tract. So this one just has a check caching store. And so that's the traditional way of analyzing things. Dennis Ronsek, who passed away recently, did the bars and blocks research essentially along similar lines to this. Now the refined method is to create GIS buffers around these features and allocate the proportion of the area of the tract that's within each buffer. So this improves it, because now if you have a feature near a boundary of a census tract, then that census tract that doesn't contain that feature has some impact from that feature. So the feature doesn't have to be in the tract to impact it. And the impact is proportional to the size of the buffer and to the size of the census tract. Essentially, you're saying what proportion of the area of that census tract is within the buffer of one of these features. The disadvantage is that it assumes the impact is uniformly distributed across the entire census tract, so it isn't site-specific. So in this example then, you would say census tract 1 has the characteristics of census tract 1 plus about, 30% of its area is within the buffer of a bar. But again, this is uniformly, the impact of this is assumed to be uniform across the entire census tract. So you say it has 30% bar impact, plus all the characteristics of census tract 1. and maybe 20% impact from a check cashing store. And over here then you would say that census tract 2 has 20% impact from of their area impacted by a check cashing store. Plus it has, this let's say is like 15%, I'm just throwing out a number, 15% of a buffer of a bar, even though the bar isn't in that census tract, okay? Because the buffer goes over here, and so you can say that maybe 15% of this area is in within the buffer of a bar. So this gives us an improvement over the traditional census tract method that we had previously. But it still leaves us with one thing that we don't like, because I want to tell this drug dealer where to deal directly. You know, I don't want to say that 20% of the census tract is within a check cashing store. That's good. He wants to know where is that check cashing store, doesn't he? You know, and this doesn't tell us. It just says 20% of the area is within the buffer of a check cashing store. And we want to take it a little bit farther than that. The GIS method then is to create new geographies using the census boundaries, but refining them by creating new boundaries within them. So we create new geographies with the buffers around these features. And this also allows us to look at interaction effects. Well, you can look at somebody, as David Weisberg pointed out to me very, very clearly in the meeting in Leiden. You don't need GIS for looking at these interaction effects. The GIS helps us interpret them, as we'll see as we go along. The advantages, of course, is that it doesn't assume the effects are uniformly spread over the entire census tract. And the buffers can be sized to reflect the spatial reach of each feature. We have mathematical methods of determining the sizes of these buffers. Disadvantage, of course, is the new geographies are going to vary markedly in size, so right away you have to control for area before you begin anything else. And you're going to get a lot of small slivers that lack geographic meaning. And we generally will ignore very, very small slivers that lack geographic meaning and kick them out of the analysis and move on from there. But the big thing from a stats point of view is that a lot of these areas now are going to have zero counts. And so you need have a model that takes account of the fact that you're going to have an overrepresentation of zeros in this, and we'll see this then as we go along. So in this example then, what are these areas going to look like? Well, area A is, of course, a census tract 1 without any negative features associated with it. Area B is a census tract 1 plus it has a bar in it, the impact of a bar. Area C has a bar plus a check cashing store in it. And these are all, areas that we're going to analyze. So we're drawing new geographies now, you see. So this is an area. Area C is a brand new area with boundaries that we can identify with GIS. Area D, then check cashing store, and then area E, bar plus check cashing store, etc. Going to census tract 2, area G is the characteristics of census tract 2 plus it's within the boundary of a bar. H, census tract 2, and I, check cashing, plus the census variables associated with census tract 2. So we're creating new boundaries with our GIS now, and this allows us much more refined analysis than we had previously. How are we doing, Tom? Anybody keeping track of time? This is Friday, we don't keep track of time. Okay, so we did this in Wilmington, Delaware, and we initially started with just the census tract data. So I used the first three things is what we used in the location allocation model, and then I added median income and number of children under age 5 living in poverty. And at the block group level, this explained quite a bit of variance here, 0.46 essentially, but we wanted to, again, of course, to go beyond this and to look at features then that attract potential drug users into the area. And again, borrowing from Pat, Pat and I go way back. We borrow from each other all the time. Okay. And borrowing from Pat, we used the concept of a crime generator in terms of what facilities aggregate a whole lot of people together in one spot, like a shopping mall or a school, so that when they are coming and going, they're coming and going essentially from a point in space, which gives you a nice place to sell illegal drugs. And so we looked at schools, taverns, homeless shelters, things that people are coming to and then moving out from, some of whom might be potential drug users. And we created buffers around these features to determine their aerial reach. And here then, a little bit about, I think most of you are familiar with this, how you create these buffers, but based on what we used was location quotients to determine how far out was the spatial reach of these features. Okay. And a location quotient is essentially comparing the density of drug sales arrest within that buffer with the density of drug sales arrest for the city as a whole. Actually, we used a mask city to try to, you know, get out the rich areas. But let's just leave it. For conceptual reasons, let's just say the city as a whole. Okay, so essentially you're saying how dense are the drug sales arrest, you know, per unit area within these buffers as compared to the city as a whole. And we want, of course, that density to decrease as we go out with distance monotonically if that area is attracting illegal drug dealers. And so we did buffers around, first of all, looking at regional customers. Things that would funnel in regional customers to the area. And we looked at major roads, and we created buffers about a city block wide. So 400 feet is about a city block in Wilmington, Delaware. So that's one block, two blocks, three blocks out from, it's one block, block and a half, and two blocks out from the major roads here. And you see it works nicely here. It decreases monotonically. The farther away you get from a major road, the less dense the drug sales arrests are. And so it's about 1.5 times more dense near the major roads, and then it drops off as you get closer to them. By the way, one is when you have the direct, you know, it's essentially the same as the city as a whole. And if it's less than one, it's less dense. Greater than one, more dense than the city as a whole. I-95 exits, John will be interested in that. What happened here? When you get right next to the I-95 exits, hardly anything was going on. Can you explain that, John? Exactly. You get rear-ended if you try to buy drugs on the exit of an interstate ramp. These are the ramps leading out of the interchanges, and actually it increases monotonically until you get out here several blocks away from the exit. And one of the reasons for that is that Wilmington, Delaware actually has done it right. You can't have the McDonald's easy in and easy out there. You get off of I-95 in Wilmington, anybody who's ever been there, you've got to wander around the city before you can find a way back on. So it's not easy on and easy off. And as a result, then you have to go out several blocks, actually, on one of the feeder streets going sideways, paralleling I-95 is where the drug markets tend to locate. The transit location, this is Amtrak station and the two bus stations in Wilmington. And this, you see, works out quite nicely again, decreasing monotonically with distance from these locations. Here's an example of a major highway, and you can see that sometimes this is Maryland Avenue, sometimes people park on it, but this was counted as a major highway because it's four-lane thing. The other thing we want is for this to be uniform over time. We don't want this thing to be jumping around, you know, the location quotients to be jumping around, because then probably something else is going on here. And you can see for major roads, it works out very, very nicely in that within 400 feet of a major road over time with our data here, we had 9 years worth of data, it was always high. And the next one is down, and this is the way we want it to be. What you're going to see is this is not what you get all the time. Unfortunately, we find all sorts of stuff going on in other features, such as I-95 exits here. These are the exits and entrances to I-95. This is I-95 leading through the area. And these are the buffers around him. And this is why you don't sell drugs on within 400 feet of an I-95. Actually, GIS gives you the distance from the entrance to the I-95 exit. You know, not down here, but rather up. Well, you know. So it gives you the buffer out from this. And so the first buffer out is this exit ramp. And nobody sells drugs on an exit ramp of an interstate highway that I know of. But you see, the things are not nearly as nice here. Generally, 1,600 feet out is higher, but at one point it drops below 2,000 feet out and then up again, you know, and so forth. So it's not nearly as nice. And the only thing that's nice is within 400 feet, it's way, way below one, and very below one, you know, in some years. I don't know who's selling drugs in that area, but that's the only thing that works out here. So this is the transit locations. These are the two bus stations, and this is the Amtrak station. And again, the buffers. And this one you can see clearly, probably the police have changed their practices, because it was actually at or below one until 1993. And then all at once, it looks like the police started focusing on these areas, or something occurred. These areas didn't change. Probably what changed was police practice, because three is really high, three times the air, you know, et cetera. So what happened then is all at once around 1993, it jumped up very, very high, and it was probably a change in police focus on these areas that was occurring. Then we looked at local accessibility, and here we looked at the nodes for routine activities. What type of a feature would attract individuals who are potential drug users to an area, I'm sorry, to a location, I should say, so that drug dealers could set up around those locations and make a lot of money. Now, this is the one the drug dealers actually want me to tell them about, isn't it? You know, where should I actually locate my drug dealing? And here we get some interesting features as well. And almost all the research out there, high schools are attraction for illegal drug dealers. In Wilmington, we see that's not the case. And so what is going on in Wilmington? Well, the answer is that Wilmington closed all their high schools, and they bused their kids to the suburbs for desegregation reasons. So during the desegregation thing, they just closed all their high schools and bused their kids to the better schools in the suburbs. Still do. Wilmington doesn't have a public high school. All they have is charter schools, and in these charter schools, the kids are driven or are bused to school as well. So the schools in Wilmington have no impact, it's right around one, on illegal drug sales, which is really quite interesting. Philadelphia, it's phenomenal. The high schools are tremendous attractors of illegal drug dealers. Now we get into some other interesting things. Again, borrowing John X stuff. What's the difference between taverns and liquor stores? A tavern is when you go in and buy a drink and sit there and drink it so that you have a place manager. Liquor stores, you buy a bottle and you leave. And what we see is that liquor stores are, in fact, higher in the aggregation of drug sales arrests than are taverns. And furthermore, what you're going to see when we get into this is that it isn't probably the taverns, it's where the taverns are located. In other words, it's contextual. The whole area around taverns has high drug sales arrests. It isn't just around the tavern, while the liquor stores tend to be much more concentrated of the drug sales arrests around them, which is really quite interesting. It's a whole place management thing, I think, going on here. Again, I'm jumping, you know, assuming, but that's the one that makes this armchair theorizing that I just criticized, but that's what makes sense to me, okay, is going on here. Check cashing stores, high pawn shops. This one also is an anomaly. Elijah Anderson said pawn shops are banks for the poor and drug dealers, and here we find nothing going on around a pawn shop. That's about as low as you can get. Police station, we'll show you what is happening here. Courts. This one is really interesting. This is fire stations. is very, very well documented that fire stations tend to dampen down crime. Criminals don't like to hang out around fire stations. This is, you know, quite well documented in the literature, and we find that true in Wilmington. Fire people will be cleaning hoses. Then they actually talk to the neighborhood kids a lot and things of that nature. And this is pretty well documented at fire stations. And then homeless shelter. 2 minutes? Well, we're going to shoot through this
thing. Well, since we started about 10 minutes later, we'll push just a few minutes on.
Okay, so
that's a quick question.
Yeah.
Were you just including these items within these clusters, or is this citywide?
No, these are the buffers.
Did you just look at the pawn shops within these identified clusters of the high crime regions, or are these like...
Oh, no, this one is citywide. I'm sorry, this is citywide. We didn't mask on this. The masking was a bad idea, and this is citywide.
Okay.
Yeah. Routine activity, and so I'm going backwards, okay. Let's move ahead, and I already talked about the schools. Here are the taverns. So what I want you to notice here is that the difference between the red lines and the green and the blue is not very wide, and at one point it actually drops below them for taverns. And notice what happens on liquor stores. It's higher and it remains way above, which tends to mean that the taverns are locating in bad areas, not necessarily attracting the illegal drug dealers, while the liquor stores have a cluster. It drops off more once you go to the 800 feet for the liquor stores than for the taverns, which implies then that they're actually attracting the drug dealers. Example of a liquor store, SIDS, check cashing store, pawn shops, not much going on here. The police buffer, clearly, nothing was happening at the police station until the police became very undermanned. Some people said that they may have gotten a global positioning system in their car, and then what they tended to do is they forgot to locate where they made the arrest. They would look at when they got to the station, and they would put the station down as the location of the arrest. So what was going on here was probably bad policing. Fire stations, nothing around them. This is really quite good. Homeless shelters. Okay, so we're running out of time. So generally then the GIS, I just want to run through this process of analysis here quickly. We would locate the crime generators and the criminal attractors on the map. Unfortunately, this is the Mass City. This is just for this illustration. I actually used the entire city. And then we do the buffers around them for homeless shelters and social service agencies. The buffers actually went out to 800 feet because it was more of a donut effect. It actually increased out the second block, while for check cashing stores, taverns, liquor stores was 400 feet. Created buffers around the line features, statistically analyzed the importance of each, et cetera. And so quickly here then, this is our data. We only use drug sales arrests. We didn't use possession because a lot of times the police will chase a person a while before they'll arrest them for possession. Well, drug sales arrests are more likely to take place in where the drug dealing is taking place. So we didn't use the possession data. We just used the drug sales arrest data. And for the entire city, that gave us about 10,193 points. Not about, that's what it gave us. Okay, so we did have many areas with zeros, so we had to use a zero inflated Poisson model or a similar model we could have used. This is a little bit like hurdle regression, where it's a two-stage model where you pass a hurdle, and once you pass the hurdle, then you can analyze what's on the other side of the hurdle. The example is commonly used is how many children a couple decides to have. The first decision is whether or not to have children. And there's a group of variables associated with whether or not to have children. But once they decide to have children, then there's another group of variables associated with how many children to have. Not the same, you say. So here we're interested in whether or not an area could have an illegal drug market in it, and then if it could have an illegal drug market in it, what determines the size of that drug market. It can have an illegal drug market. So zero inflated poison model. And quickly here, what we found in terms of the yes-no, whether it had a drug market or not, was the percentage of non-white residents was highly associated with whether or not it had a drug sales market. This is not satisfactory to us. We're going to try to get around this because it isn't being non-white. It's what is there about being non-white? You know, there was probably, you know, income and family structure and a lot of other things going on. So we're going to try to get around this gross variable of white non-white going on here. But the spatial lag term is the number of arrests in the surrounding area increases the chances of the parcel never having a drug sales arrest diminishes. This is good. Then the interesting one, it was negatively associated with I-95 exits. Being located near an exit ramp at I-95, I should say actually 600 feet of this is our buffer out there, increases the chance that the area won't have a drug sales area. Okay, and this is really quite interesting. We're going to see that this whole thing is contextual, and John actually wrote a whole article on the contextual nature of an exit from a limited access highway that I use in my class. The rest are not statistically significant. Now, when we get to the size of the area, notice that I-95 jumps in. So if they do have a drug market there, I-95 says it's going to be a large one. Okay, so it's going to be contextual. You know, where it's going to be that one, and I shouldn't say one, but it's a certain number of exits, and if they do have a drug market there, it's going to be a large drug market. And then these are less theoretically the liquor store. If they have a drug market there, liquor store means it's going to be a large one. And the spatial lag term is, of course, important here. If the surrounding area has a large number of drug sales, this area is going to have a large number of drug sales, which means there are agglomeration economies going on there. So contrary to a lot of the folk wisdom that drug dealers fight with each other and keep the corner for themselves, what we find with illegal drug dealers is the same thing we find with prostitution. There are strolls. Do the prostitutes duke it out? No, they talk to each other and get along. The John comes up, and you know they have some sort of routine as to who gets the John. And the drug dealers seem the same thing is going on. So it's a little bit the agglomeration economies in the real world. I think most of you recognize this in the terms of automobile dealers. Why do all the automobile dealers locate in one location? And the answer is, if you're going to buy a car, that's where you go. Okay? Why do all the drug dealers locate in one location or agglomerate in space? Because if you're going to buy drugs, that's where you go. If you want a prostitute, that's where you go. You don't go to UCLA, you go to, you know, where the prostitutes are.
Don't say USC.
I held them. So what's going on here are agglomeration economies that the larger it is, actually, the more profitable it is to a limit, of course. All right, and so there are agglomeration economies going on here, contrary to the popular, you know, belief out there. Negatively associated renter-occupied units. This one is interesting. When this came up, I wrung my hands. But we now that we're seeing more and more research, finding rental areas actually associated with low rather than high crime rates. We're finding that more and more. And I don't know what's going on here. Social service programs and taverns. Taverns dampen down the size of the area. Okay, interestingly enough, so contrary to the bars and blocks, what we're finding is taverns tend to be associated with smaller drug sales areas. Liquor stores, larger ones. Okay. Real quickly here, we're about out of time, so I'm not going to go through a lot of these significant things. I've already touched on most of these. You know, the environmental racism, you know, type of argument, social efficacy, you know, counter argument going on. Is it that drug dealing is a noxious activity and does it take place in the weakest communities? Or is it that the black areas don't lack social efficacy, don't take advantage of the social resources available to them, such as police, We have Don't Snitch t-shirts in Philly. I should have worn one today. So what we need at this point, of course, is to determine interaction effects. And especially we need this for I-95 exits. It's not all the exits, it's contextual. And we need this for liquor stores, bars, etc. So again, running through this, we have census block groups. We put these things on here. And then with, so this is basically what we're analyzing, is that you can see there's a lot of little splinters there. But these are all areas. These are census block groups, and these are the buffers around the areas. This is what we're analyzing. And then you can construct logically Bayesian questions like, give me all the liquor stores or taverns that are located on a major road near an I-95 exit. And GIS will give you that. These are all the liquor stores and taverns located near an these are the I-95 buffers here, going through down through here, that are located on major roads near an I-95 buffer. So we can now get contextual stuff. But the problem is, do we want to do that contextual stuff logically, armchair theorizing, or do we want to do it statistically? And I argue, well, there's arguments for both ways here, of course, but I argue that we ought to at least try the statistical method, such as answer tree. There's several other of these out there. This is in SPSS. But if you have the drug sales arrest for the entire city, it just simply says what variable explains most of the variance in those drug sales arrests. And you can force a first split. And I think this is good, because the first split would naturally be the black-white. And I don't like the black-white, because I think there's a whole lot of, about the black population that's more interested in than the fact that they're black, or a white population that they're white, et cetera. So you can force the first split here on, for instance, income, and say split it on median income, and then let it naturally go through its trees. For the low-income people then, variable then explains most of the variance within the low-income, and it'll give you another group here and another group here. And then it'll search through all those four groups to see which one has the most variance. And then it'll locate the factor that explains most of that variance and give you that split. And you'll keep going with trees getting larger and larger and larger, so that you can then find that the most drug sales in an area will probably be over in the left-hand side. It will be this, low income, etc. And then you can start analyzing your interaction effects. And that's where we are at present. Liz is going to help me. And we're going to continue on. Thank you very much.